Good afternoon. I'll call to order the State Government Budget Division for March 25, 2009. Let the record reflect we have a quorum present. We have a few bills on the agenda today. We'll start with Senate File 182, Senator Polga Miller's bill on legislative and congressional districting principles establishment and redistricting commission creation. Senator Polga Miller, welcome to the Budget Division.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate you taking the time. This is a bill that sets up a panel to do redistricting of five retired judges, and they would do redistricting based on a set of principles that is outlined in Section 1. And those principles are based on case law, constitutional requirements, and best practices around the country. Nesting, equal population, contiguity, compactness, minority representation, preserving political subdivisions, community of interest. The one on page 2, line 2.28, political competitiveness, has not been generally used around the country, but it is emerging in the last few years from academia, others, good government groups, that think that should be a criteria that should be added. Those criteria are based on priority, so there is a balancing act between these various criteria and drafting districts, and none of them can be individually always specifically achieved, and so it's a balancing act between the various criteria, and the order, rank order of them is how one has to consider that. So the most important is equal population, then comes compactness, then comes minority representation in that order. The five-judge panel is an attempt to take the direct interest by legislators out of drawing their own districts. By Constitution, the legislature has the responsibility to do redistricting. We're not changing that. Because under this construct, this five-judge panel would draw districts and the legislature would vote yes or no, and would go through a three-step process potentially. If they drew a map and the legislature thought it was a good map and it passed and the governor signed it, it would be over. If the legislature rejects the first map, then this five-judge panel would come back with a second map and the legislature would vote it up or down. If they voted down or the governor vetoes it, they would come up with a third map, and the legislature could either adopt that map or alter the map. So the constitutional requirement that the legislature controls this is maintained, but as a process under which they can control it, this law would allow for some distancing from the direct political process of elected officials drawing their own districts. The five-judge panel would be picked in this manner, one each by the leaders of the four caucuses in the House and the Senate, and then those four would pick a fifth judge, and then among themselves they would choose a chair. There's a schedule in here that I don't need to go through, but the whole idea is to try to just remove some of the directness of the legislature drawing its own map. Why would we do this? Some would argue we should do this because it's just unsightly to have politicians draw their own maps. I would argue that, okay, but that's not the basic reason to do this. I would argue that you can never totally take the politics out of this, and those who drew our Constitution understood that. In the end, there are always political judgments being made here. And the question is, who gets to make the political judgments? In this scenario, it would not be legislators directly themselves in the first instance. It would be less political judges. But as we all know, judges are political also. Very few people became judges without having some political connections. But they're not drawing their own districts, so you do separate it from that. What I think the basic reason to do this is twofold. One, getting this criteria in law so that everybody understands that there is a fairness to how these districts are being drawn. So to me, the criteria is the crucial factor here, and I think we should have those in statute so that everybody knows here's the rules of the game. Then secondly, I believe that In most instances, this process will be quicker and less time-consuming than the current process we go under. Typically, over the history of redistricting, these decisions end up in the courts, and courts start making decisions. And I won't go through all the detail of this, but in general, courts end up doing this. And it just seems like it might be more efficient to just move to something that would avoid as much court action as possible, if you could. So that's the rationale for the bill. There's a fiscal note that, because there would be some costs to having this panel. They would need staff. They would need computers. And the fiscal note says it's $141,000 in the 11-12 cycle. So this is the out years. That's why the bill is here. So it would not directly impact our budget for 9 and 10, but there would be a cost of 11 and 12. I would argue that this is not necessarily a new cost, because these dollars will be spent. It's just who's going to spend it. Is the legislature going to spend it, or the courts going to spend it? And typically what happens in the past is both the legislature and the court spends this money, and it costs us more. So this might, although I'm not guaranteeing this, but there's a possibility that this will make the process both it will make it more transparent potentially, but it also potentially could make it more timely and less costly. Although there's no guarantee on that, because if the panel draws bad maps, then in the end the legislature will draw the maps anyway. On a partisan matter, let me just say there will be many Democrats who say, right at this moment in time, well, why would Democrats give up the authority since it looks like they're going to control the legislature? Okay, well, how about next decade? Maybe that won't be the case. And in any instance, you're not certain that you have the executive branch, too. And if you do have all three branches, it might seem like it's easy to do this. Trust me, it just changes the politics. Then it's a question of members fighting among themselves about who gets a better district, and so you don't take the politics out of it even then. And so this is an attempt to draw on kind of the positive aspects out of legislators about think through this for a second. This may work as well as you would like it to and even be more transparent, and the voters would be more comfortable. And it doesn't remove your ultimate power. And to some extent, I believe it's an illusion that legislators have that they have a lot of control over how these maps get drawn, because in most instances, the courts end up drawing them. So, Chairman, that's my basic argument, and would appreciate consideration.
Thank you, Senator Polgemiller. Senator Kubley is not on the State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee, but the other members who are here right now are on it, so I think we heard the discussion when it was in the policy committee. So I
should have been briefer. Sorry.
No, that's fine. Our focus will be on the fiscal note. It looks like there's going to be two part-time employees hired to assist the judges. The office space is going to be in the judicial building at no cost. They'll procure the specialized GIS equipment and software and some supplies and so forth. Some travel expenses are for public meetings, and so that seems to be what is anticipated.
Senator it's become Pappas. A lot less expensive because of technology.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Senator Polgemiller, are the retired judges paid for this work?
I hadn't thought through that. I suppose they'd get some per diem or something, but
per diem?
I think per diem under this construct. It's so much fun, maybe they'd volunteer their services. But no, I think the construct is assuming per diem.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'm trying to read through here to see if that's anticipated. It does anticipate that the...
You look at 321.
Page 3, line 21.
It's 15075. Okay. That's the general select section for that kind of reimbursement that Senator Polgemiller is referring to.
Okay. Per diem.
As is noted in the fiscal note, the bill itself right now does not have an appropriation, mainly because... I guess the fiscal note wasn't available. We do have the fiscal note A3 amendment.
There's an A3 amendment, Mr.
Yeah, you've seen that, Senator Polgemiller.
I have.
This has the appropriation of $141,000 to the general fund, from the general fund to the LCC for the expenses related to the commission. Senator Russ?
Please. Can we see it? And then I have a question.
Oh, I'm sorry. It hasn't been. It's being distributed.
So,
at all. Okay.
Since it doesn't, there won't be expenditure of money until FY11. Is this? I'm trying to think of the years here. That's still in this biennium, though.
Yes, I misspoke.
Yes. Okay. So it's.
I misspoke.
$141,000 to the in the second year to start it going. Is that correct?
That is correct. Well, the next biennium will start July 1st of 09 and go through June 30th of 11. So the budget we're preparing right now is that biennium, which goes, and this is available until June 30th of 2011. So it's available to the end of the next biennium.
And then, Mr. Chairman, is it your intention if we act, as we act on the bill, to keep the appropriation in the finance division and move the policy to the full committee and then to possibly to the floor?
Well, Senator Rest, yeah, this budget division has to track the money for this bill. Frankly, I'd rather not have it in the state government budget division bill, because if somebody's going to have to confer this bill, I'd rather it be Senator Pogamiller than me going to represent Conn in my conference committee. So, Senator Pogamiller, I just assume you carry the bill, but I'll carry the money.
Yes, that's what I mean.
That's what I would hope to do. So,
and then, so do we
I'd
need
be comfortable
to,
with that.
So do we need to adopt the appropriation or just look at it as
well?
What I'm asking in terms of.
Yeah, Senator Rest, I think we need to adopt the appropriation so that we've got a number locked in here. Even though the bill will be traveling separately, we'll be tracking the number in our spreadsheets from this point forward.
So, Mr. Chairman and Senator Pogamiller, we would send the bill, assuming we'd send the bill to the floor ultimately with the appropriation on there, even though the money would be tracked here, or would you at some point remove the appropriation and we'll just pick the appropriation up if the bill's going forward? How does that
well,
work?
Well, we can Senator Rust, yeah, we can have the appropriation in this bill. I mean, it would be an outlier from our budget bill. We just have to account for it, you know, as we have our spreadsheets. As I say, it's going to be charged against our budget.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the A3 amendment.
Senator Pogamiller.
Mr. Chairman, if the bill can go without the appropriation, I'm comfortable with that, knowing that it doesn't become effective unless the appropriation passes.
Well, Senator Pogamiller and Senator Rust, I think I'd be more comfortable having the appropriation here. Just from our spreadsheet standpoint, it's just easier for us to know that there's a number out there somewhere that we can follow. If it changes along the way, it changes, but we need a number.
No, Mr. Chairman, I'm agreeing with that. I'm saying I don't know that it's necessary. This is a Finance Committee matter,
sure.
But I don't have to have the appropriation on the bill.
I understand that, Jeff. But I think having the appropriation on the bill, I think, gives more transparency to
okay.
it.
Okay, so that's fine.
So
then.
I would move the A3 amendment.
Okay, Senator Rest moves the A3 amendment. Is there a discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. The A3 amendment is adopted. Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogamiller, in the State and Local Government Committee, there was discussion about Subdivision 7 and the deadlines and for making that schedule work. And I understand that we're not going to be discussing an amendment to put that in a rational order in the finance division because it is a policy issue. But I'm assuming that at some point you'll be addressing that either in the full finance or in the rules committee or wherever you put this because right now the deadlines don't work very well, as you know, from the discussion in the state and local government.
There's an amendment drafted. Is there any reason we wouldn't just pass it, take it?
Well, Senator Pogamiller, since this is the budget division, I think I'd be more comfortable just dealing with the budget issues here.
But if they're going to discuss it in the full finance committee, wouldn't it be quicker just to
Oh, if that's your pleasure, we can do it. As I say, most of the people who are here, well, in fact, all the members who are here right now are also on the policy committee. So if that's a pleasure, we can take a look at that.
Yeah, I think it'd be cleaner just to do it here.
Why don't we do it here?
Okay,
we're going to have a copy made. While it's being made, did you want to describe overall what it does then, or
Senator Rest, do you want that? Or?
I don't have a copy of it, but what it does is to make the deadlines work with regard to the obligations of the redistricting commission to work against the deadlines that for the legislature when we are in session and when we're out of session, so that the two things are not acting in are not contradicting one another or having an obligation to submit a proposal without the accompanying responsibility for the legislature to act on it or having acted on it, the obligation of the commission to respond in a timely fashion to the next level of reporting. I think that amendment that Mr. Watson prepared now makes that it looks very complicated because it's a couple of really long sentences, but if you follow the schedule all the way along, it it solves some of the issues that the committee members brought up about the deadlines in the State and Local Government Committee that we were not able to work through because they're complicated. So that's what it does, Mr. Chairman.
Apparently the page is coming.
Yes, so he's making copies of it right now. So,
Chairman, I have looked at it. I think it does. This was quite a long discussion in Senator Rest Committee, right. And I think this resolves a lot of the discussion that took place, and it looks like it works.
Let's just wait here a second until we get the copies.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
As long as we're killing time here.
They're coming in right now, so okay.
Senator Pogamiller, I just wanted to complain that the last go-round, Subdivision 6 was not really very, 2.12, was not really done very well in my district. The A and the B side of my district, the line is right down the heart of the traditional African-American community. So it really, although it created a district for Representative Tao, you know, among in the Hmong community, and we certainly still had a Latino community of interest for Representative Mariani, we really, you know, we really hurt the opportunity to have an African-American represent the district. So I wish that was moved up a little higher, but I hope that this new panel will certainly take that into consideration. I didn't feel like the judges knew, you know, where the traditional African American community is in St. Paul by the action they took.
Okay, we have the A5 amendment now, and again, does somebody? Okay, Sarah Rest moves it. Could we just again describe what it says now that we got the language?
It's setting the deadlines for when the first report must come to the legislature. For both the redistricting for the congressional seats and for the legislature by April 30th, and sets up that the legislature, if you're looking at paragraph A, either has to say yes or no. And then if in B, if the first plan is rejected, they have to submit a second plan within 2 weeks unless the legislature has rejected that first plan and adjourned the regular session in that first year. And if that's the case, then they have to submit the plan to the legislature at the beginning of the regular session. And then the same rule applies to the second plan, up or down, but not modified. Then if they fail, for one thing, if they fail to submit a plan by those deadlines, then the legislature can do what they choose, because as Senator Pogamiller indicated, the legislature is constitutionally responsible. However, in D, if that second plan, having been presented in a timely fashion, is rejected by the legislature, then the commission shall submit a third plan, again within 2 weeks of the rejection, unless That second plan, and this is where it gets a little complicated, unless that second plan was rejected in the first year and the legislature adjourned in less than 2 weeks after it rejected the second plan. In that case, then the third plan has to be, if the third plan has to be submitted by the opening day of the new session. And then again, because the legislature has no deadlines within here, the legislature can accept, reject, or modify the third plan. So the amendment addresses what happens when things occur at the end of a session and at the beginning of the new session, so that things keep rolling along, but that the commission is not expected to act bam, bam, bam with three plans in year 01 if they have only submitted that first plan by April 30th.
Okay. So. Are we clear? Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Ress, so then I would assume that if the third plan was rejected by the legislature, then it would, again, be back to the courts to do the redistricting.
Senator Ress.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, not necessarily. I mean, the legislature could reject that third plan and come up with its own and
pass it. Okay, so my question is, if the legislature does not come up with its own plan.
If the legislature does not come up with its own plan following rejection and lack of modification in the third submission, then the legislature can do whatever it wants. But, of course, if it adjourns without adopting a plan, one would assume that a citizen would appeal to the courts to have the matter taken up in the courts. But if the legislature adopts a plan, then it's law.
But Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Rest,
and the governor signs it, of course.
If this is in 2012, that's the year we're supposed to run in new districts, right?
And that's when the districts are usually decided.
But, you know, this not decided until the summer.
No,
that's the worst case scenario. But
no, it'd be early in the session. Senator Pogamiller?
Yes, that.
I see. It would be earlier in session.
Right. But, okay. And the way the current situation works, the courts go into action based on that timeline because they kind of make the presumption that the legislature is not going to get a signed bill into law. And so what this does is says we're moving that up pretty much a year, and hopefully you have a plan done that can withstand further court scrutiny and everybody's happy, relatively.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I missed the policy discussion. So I have one more question, and that is, and this assumes that we have all the redistricting information by 2011.
Yes.
Right.
And that's
The 2010 census.
Right. The 2010 census. By 2011, we have all the
data. And as I recall, after the 2000 census, I mean, the data was available in 2001, but we were given a deadline, but we had tripartisan government, so there was no way that we were ever going to come up with one plan that would satisfy. In fact, House sent the governor, and I think the judge of the courts gave us, until about March sometime, I think, to meet their deadline, and then they rolled out the maps and said, here they are. So, we have before us the A5 amendment. Further discussion on the A5 amendment. Senator Roebling.
I still am kind of stuck on what Senator Pappas was asking about and don't understand that if we go into the third plan in the second year and say the legislature didn't convene until the middle of February like we did last year, that really does push us back. I mean, precinct caucuses are set for about that time. And so, I mean, I suppose it gives incentive to the legislature to really seriously look at one of the plans in the year ending with one. Otherwise, they won't know for a long time where they're running.
Exactly. I think the way to think about this kind of in the real world is that assuming this panel puts together a plan that certainly follows these criteria, there's going to be a majority of legislators that are for the plan. And the reason is because most people tend to vote on, if my district doesn't change too much, I'm a happy camper. And that's really what I think is going to happen. Mm-hmm. Now, congressional could be a little different because there's only 8 or 7 seats. And there, you probably could pull together a bunch of legislators who just said, we as a group don't like that plan. With legislators, it's a lot different. It's hard to gather. It's hard for me to convince Senator Pappas that she should vote in my self-interest and reject a plan because I don't like my district, when she's sitting there looking at her district going, a bird in the hand's better than... I mean, that to me, that's the reality of the likelihood of a legislative. Congressional could be a little different because there's a lot fewer districts. But the one thing about congressional districts, they have to be the exact population. Exact. No deviation.
2%.
Whereas legislative districts, you have usually you do a 2% up or down, 2% variance. The courts allow you to do up to 5% variance, but usually you do 1 or 2%.
Yeah. As I recall, both in Senator Pogam, you know this better than I do, but I think in both 1992 and 2002, the districts were not set in time for precinct caucuses and in some cases for the convention. So you had the situation going on where people went to caucuses, which didn't really matter, but they had to have conventions in their old districts and conventions in their new districts as the new maps were coming on out, which caused some confusion. So there is a premium to get these things done early. So.
Yes. That was the year that a Democratic legislature passed a plan.
Right.
The executive branch was not successful in its veto, botched the veto,
right.
And we ended up going to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Right.
And the U.S. Supreme Court took it up quick enough so that we literally could hold an election. And I believe that case was heard in June in the U.S. Supreme Court. Oh, I see. Okay. So the courts take this stuff very serious, and they want to make elections possible. So if we don't do it, they will. And you know, frankly, the courts appear to enjoy doing this.
They must.
One year we had dueling panels drawing maps, a federal panel and a state panel.
Senator Wilson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Senator Pogemiller, however this works out, I'm very worried about the next census because Senator Roebling and I, we both have over 90,000 people in our district, and there's quite a few of us that have way over, almost 20,000 over what the 75,000 number. And so how that plays out is going to be an interesting story.
Yes. One of the things that's, well, I don't want to create more tension for members, but it would seem that you could just assume you're going to keep your same boundaries and just make it smaller. maybe not, because other districts have to gain population too. So there's... It's not quite as simple as I get to keep everything I want and either that I already have and either lose a few or gain a few. It doesn't always work out that way when you're in that third tier, because that's where the fracture point is. You take the south, you take the northeast, Senator Stumpf's area, that district's got to get bigger. And once you do that, it starts to move things. Because there are edges on the state.
But my district's too big, too. I got too many people. And there is a way to draw a map, Senate map, to put both Senator Pogemiller and I in the same Senate district. That's an arrest.
I was going to say, well, I need some of your folks.
Well, that scares me.
But, it'd be a long, narrow map.
I think it also depends on, like, where you live inside your own district. If you live on the edge of it right now, then there's more uncertainty about whether, if your district shrinks, it's going to shrink without you and even create a district in which there's no incumbent. And that's what occasions some people having to move, and of course they have to live in that new district 6 months. Is it Senator Pogemiller? 6 months prior to the election. So you would have to have be living in that district, that new district, by April.
Ms. Chairman, for the record,
yes.
I would be absolutely honored to have some of your constituents in my district.
By the way, in order to get you and me in the same district, we'd also have to pick up Senator Chaudhary, too, because he's between the two of us. So all three of us could be in the same district. So anyway, different issue. Okay, we have the A5 amendment before us. Is there further germane discussion on the A5 motion amendment? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. The A5 amendment's adopted. Is there anybody else who's here who wants to be heard on Senate File 182? Any further discussion? Is there a motion? As I said, my preference is to send to the Finance Committee, and then we'll just track the money in my budget bill. And
I move that Senate File
182,
as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the full Finance Committee.
Okay. Senator Rust moves that Senate File 182, as amended, be recommended to pass, be referred to the Committee on Finance. Discussion on that motion.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogamiller.
I think I know the answer to this. There's no way you could send this right to the floor, is there?
No. We're a budget division.
I know. I'm just looking at the makeup of the full Finance Committee.
Senator Pogamiller, the yellow jackets are in a file cabinet that's in Senator Cohen's office. If you can figure out how to
move them from there,
if you can figure out how to get those jackets out of that office and get them to the floor without
the wonderful role model.
Okay,
Mr. Roulette is a wonderful role model.
He looks over our shoulders. On that motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Aye. Thank you, Senator Pogamiller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
See you at Finance. Okay, next bill up is, Senator Rust, which bill did you want to do first, the capital bonding bill or, okay. Senate File 1354, Senator Rust, state capital bonding bill issue and appropriation.
Mr. Chairman, you have in your packet some information about the status of the improvements to the Capitol, and Senate File 1354 addresses those issues as well, asking for $3 million from bond proceeds to be given to the Commissioner of Administration for the purposes of the planning and pre-design and whatever. We have already been favorably included in Senate file in Section 33 of the proposed capital bonding bill, which is not yet on the floor, I don't believe. Has it gotten through full finance?
The bonding bill?
Yeah.
Well, Senator Langsdorff brought up the bonding bill, a bonding bill, which we passed, but we had to table it because we have to wait for the House.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. Of course.
Yeah.
So it's on the floor, and this provision, I've forgotten about that, Section 33 in the bonding bill includes the $13.4 million for the work regarding stabilizing the plaza, replacement and stabilization of the building's exterior envelope, replacement of air handling units that are at risk of failure, and projects to improve interior emergency lighting, dome lighting, and catwalks. And then, more to the point of my bill here, up to $2 million of that appropriation may be used for pre-design and schematic design work to restore and renovate the Capitol and meet related space and functional requirements. This budget division has been enthusiastically in support of renovation, restoration of the Capitol building, and we do have people here from the commissioner and others from to talk to us and update us about the work that's being done on the Capitol, and I would invite them to come forward to explain briefly where we are in that process.
Please welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Excuse me. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Nikki Giancola. I'm from the Department of Administration, and
Just a couple of comments, and then Wayne Wazlowski from our Real Estate and Construction Services can take over and describe in more detail what we're finding in the building and our plans for mitigation of what we're finding. But just in general, I just comment that obviously you all know that this building is just a magnificent, beautiful building. Even to the regular visitor to the building, it may appear to be in fine shape, but it's really what you don't see. It's the mechanicals, the electricals, the plumbing. It's the things behind the wall that are way beyond preventive maintenance and repair anymore. We're looking at needs that are of a greater scale. It's going to take more work, more disruption to really get at and address the underlying problems with the building. The building's over 100 years old. The age of the systems in the building is considerable, and they're just getting older every day. Equipment over the years has been added incrementally rather than holistically, and with the capital renovation plan, that would be kind of the crux of where we would see this going, is a more holistic look at restoring the building. There's a lot of physical deterioration taking place. Some is visible, such as the water that you see and the damage that we have seen on the third floor, but it's also behind the walls. It's the crumbling pipes. It's insufficient airflow. It's very taxed electrical and technology-type systems in the building. And it's even on the exterior of the building, and we've got a couple of photos to kind of demonstrate this. Even the marble carvings on the outside of the building, the detailing that makes up those carvings is crumbling away, literally. So in terms of wear and tear, the building truly is high exposure. It's, you know, very well used. It serves more than 250,000 visitors a year. It has it houses over 600 employee type occupants, and it holds over 600 hearings and meetings a year as well. So anyway, to wrap it up here, just to address the deficiencies of this scale is going to take a more concerted and monumental effort than what we've been doing. We see the building needing to be fully accessible by everybody, including those with disabilities. We see it needing to be safer and more secure. We need to make sure that reliability is improved in whatever we take on, and that truly it's modernized to support 21st century technology and functioning of state government. So with that, I think I'll turn it over to Mr. Wazlowski. He can just run us through what we're finding and how we're planning to use the appropriation that we did get in the bonding bill last year.
And we, this budget division, did take a tour. We haven't had a change of membership except for Senator Urson leaving, but we took a tour of the in the tunnels and so forth, got under the front steps in the last biennium. So if anything, it's gotten worse since then. In fact, this doorway right out here to University Avenue, some visitors may notice it's been blocked off, one of the doors, because it's been crumbling there. We had a pipe burst in the women's restroom, I think, about a month or two ago. So it's getting worse. So, Mr. Wislot, Senator Pappas.
I don't have any heat in my office.
You don't have any heat in your office?
No.
None of us do.
Yeah.
I have to tell you that I, when it got really bad, and I don't know if it was December or so on, I went down stairs from my office and more or less burst into Matt Kramer's office and screamed at him for about 2 minutes about how cold it was. And he acknowledged that it was also very, very cold in the governor's suite of offices as well, and acknowledged the problem, but, you know.
But told you to bring in a space heater.
Actually, don't say that in front of the commissioner of administration.
Oh.
But there are illegal space heaters in the building that are using electricity to keep some people warm, that if we had been able to start on modernizing those systems, people would not feel compelled to, in order to keep warm and be able to work at their desks, to bring in illegal space heaters.
That must be in the Attorney General's office, the governor's office. I can't imagine the legislative branch would have them. But Mr. Wazlowski.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Wayne Wislosky. I'm the Director for Real Estate and Construction Services for the Department of Administration. And I just want to go through this handout in your packet. We have two existing appropriations that we're working with. In 2006, we had $2.4 million that was appropriated. $1.4 million was to start to look at the repair and restoration of the Capitol Dome, which I'll go into in detail a little bit more later. Then we also had $1 million to do schematic design work. As you know, that schematic design work has been completed, but that is the plan that so far to date we don't have consensus on moving forward with. Then in 2008, there was a request submitted to for really what was deemed as critical and more emergency-related repairs, and that was $13.4 million. And I'll just go through real quickly. Obviously, the need is much greater than the available funds. And so our focus is on the greatest vulnerabilities for the building. And the top of that list is the Capitol Dome. And we have really three separate domes that I think you've probably seen drawings of this before. And I maybe
there, we have it in.
Actually, it's in the packet as well, that shows there's an outer dome, a middle dome, and an interior dome. The interior dome is what you see when you're looking up from the inside of the building. Obviously, the exterior dome is the marble that you see from the exterior, but within there's a middle dome that really provides the structural supports and a lot of the waterproofing, structural supports for the lantern as well as waterproofing. Cassie Gilbert knew the marble would leak. I think everybody was aware as part of the original design that the outer dome would leak water, and the goal is to control the water once it gets inside into the middle dome, and that's where we're. Over the past year, we did an investigation to expose some of the 22 structural columns that we have, and we did see some deterioration and water damage in the structural columns. So what we will be doing is exposing all of those structural columns. We'll also be, as part of that, adding some additional internal drainage into that area. As far as the exterior on the marble, we'll be doing some repointing of the mortar and those joints. It should be noted that right now we have budgeted $6 million for that work. That does not include some of the repair work that's going to be necessary on the inside of the inner dome, that there's still damage that will need to be repaired. Obviously, we want to make sure we're controlling the water that's coming in before we do any of the interior restoration work. As part of that, we're also going to be adding ventilation to both the inner dome and the middle dome. A couple other things that we're looking at is we're also doing, you've seen, I think, last year, I think we were hauling around a section of an internal rain leader that was badly damaged. And we are now going through, back when the building was built, there wasn't a full set of plans and specs that like you would have today. So we don't know exactly where all the internal rain leader piping and plumbing stack piping goes. So the first step will be to do a comprehensive fiber optic mapping of that piping. We'll obviously document the location of that piping and the condition of that piping. We really don't know how much that's ultimately going to cost to fix the damage. We're first going to have to do the investigation to see what kind of condition it's in, and then we'll go from there. The other piece that we've always talked about is the condition of the air handling units. They're obviously at the majority of them are at the end of their useful life, and so we essentially just are watching those, and as needed, we'll be able to use this funding to replace any of those that are going to fail. We're also looking at stabilization of some of the exterior plaza. As you've walked around, you've seen some cracking. You've probably seen some heaving. That repair work needs to be done not only from a safety standpoint, but also from a waterproofing standpoint from the building. So that's also an important item for us to continue to do work on. Until we can proceed with a more comprehensive restoration.
So, Senator Rest, the bill would appropriate $3 million for the planning and pre-design study. that doesn't presume the outcome as to whether or not we're going to expand the building and have more meeting space or anything. It just, this is just the study to figure out what we're going to be doing next.
That's correct, Mr. Okay. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rest, how much do you think the debt service is going to be?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, I think Mr. Lundin would be the one who would give us the best estimate on that.
I'd have to check. And get
okay. He'd have to check so forth. But
Mr. Chairman, I actually think that's important to know, since you're asking for the money out of the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, it'd be mm-hmm. important to know how much is in that fund. And, you know, if it's $30 million and this is going to cost $300,000, then it's like I'm not concerned. If it's $10 million and this is going to cost, it's not going to cost that much. But
no, I understand, Mr. Chairman estimates? And Senator Pappas, and I don't know. We're trying, obviously, not only with the money that's in the bonding bill that I wanted people to be aware of, that this is
money in the bonding bill.
This is something different from what's in the bonding bill. It's a different source of funds that you just pointed out from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. But we know that those dollars can be appropriately expended for public buildings. And, the thing that bothers me about the Capitol, quite frankly, is that it ends up with a very limited constituency in terms of advocates, and those people on this committee know that only too well, and that so we need to be aggressive in as advocates for the building to go to, quite frankly, where the money is, and there's some in the bonding bill, but you don't have to look very far on these pictures. You know, where's the next rain leader going to burst? Mm-hmm. It's going to be in your office or Senator Kubley's office. We wish it could be in an office that everybody, all members, in my opinion, of the Senate ought to be their offices ought to be in this building. If we're able ever to expand the usable Capitol space. It seems to me one of the appropriate uses would be to have all members of the Senate have their offices here and release space that's in the state office building for the use of the Minnesota House. Short of that, there are many things that we can do that don't even involve expansion at this point and need to do sooner rather than later.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, is this bill then going to full finance committee on its own?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Rest, yeah.
I don't know.
I think so. I mean, it's a capital investment bill. So ultimately, I think rather than having a bonding issue in the state government budget bill, which would mean it'd have to be a House file, you'd have to meet the requirements of passing it, I think it'd be better off just to move it out separately. And then the Capital Investment Committee can gather the bills as they see them and do what they wish with them.
But it'll go to full finance before
it has to go to full finance before it moves on to Capital Investment.
I was going to say that maybe we could.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn has the House companion, and I would assume that she'd be moving it along in the same way to the Capital Investment Committee.
I might want to finish my point, which is I'd just like to know that, have that information about how much it's going to cost before we're in full finance.
We will.
When we're in full finance.
Mr. Chairman, I'll ask Mr. Mossman, I guess, to give us
We can follow up with
Department of Administration. We'll make sure that the Finance Committee has that information.
Is there anybody else who's here to be heard on Senate File 1354? Any further discussion? Senator Rest then moves that Senate File 1354 be recommended to pass, be referred to the Committee on Finance. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Senator Rest, Senate File 530, repealing a report on revenue relating to personal income. And the repealed information is on the back of the
bills, so.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, a number of years ago, ancient history, then-Senator Jean Merriam in the Senate and I in the House worked on a bill that dealt with the price of government, what so-called price of government, where we were trying to set up a tool that could be used to educate legislature and the public about the percentage of personal income in the aggregate that was used to support state and local government. We only looked at the revenue side. We never could agree on the spending side. What happened with the price of government, we had requirements that the governor had to act on it, present it, and then that the legislature had to act on it, and sometimes by certain dates, and sometimes they did, and sometimes they didn't. And the price of government itself ended up being, instead of a tool, it ended up being more often a weapon to, I felt, unfairly discredit the ways in which local governments were operating, and it became something more than unintended, more than an educational tool. In 2007, most of the provisions of the price of government were repealed in the state government finance bill, as I think that's the bill that it was in. Yes, it was. But we did have we still retained in law a report that needed to be made, and that is, if you look at 16A102, what the repealer is, that is that report, and it seems to me that report also has very limited use, and I don't believe that it furthers our understanding about this subject at all anymore, and I think it's time to repeal the report as well. And this was I'd like to say on our part, a well-intentioned first start back in the 90s, but it was never completed because there was just too much controversy over the spending part, and then it began to be used for other purposes than it was intended, and I think we should get rid of the report as well as we've already gotten rid of the requirements on the governor and the legislature.
So Senator Rest, this is a report that comes from the Department of Revenue, or Finance, I'm sorry.
Yeah, Finance.
Okay. On personal income, and I whether the report is prepared by the Department of Finance, Minnesota Management Budget, or not, the information I take it is readily available, is it not? I mean, I think that if somebody wanted to compare,
if you wanted to get it, you could get it. But I don't see why they need to do what otherwise is an unnecessary report.
I see.
That is not, as far as I know, not used by anyone that I know of to get an understanding of the way in which personal income, the revenues from personal income, personal income is used as a measure against revenues coming into the state. We sometimes hear that the price of government has gone up or down. Often people will talk about that, but they don't talk about what it means. And I just think it is obsolete. It's just not useful anymore. And I don't see why we have to have the report as well as we've already gotten rid of the obligations for the governor to prepare it and the legislature to act in some way on it.
Sir Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure I agree with Senator Rest that this is not useful anymore. You know, we've been watching it, in many regards, the price. I think it is helpful to have a collection of what is the price of state and local government. What are we doing to impact the cost of government on the taxpayers? And it's useful to me to see if it's stable, to see if it's going up, to see if it's going down. I think that we then know which direction we're headed as a body, because we often steer what happens at the local units of government too. Our actions often impact theirs, of course, and so. But what cumulatively is that impact? And I think it's useful information to have.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I would too if we had the spending side of it, as well as if we had the other side of it. We only have the revenues. The revenues themselves are a term of art. There's some we put in and some we don't put in, and I'm not sure that it's very reflective of what we would like it to be as a measure of how much, what percentage of the aggregate personal income in Minnesota goes to support state and local governments. We just took a recipe of put A in but not B, where there was not any particular rationale for not putting B in, but we put A and C and F and G and H and I, and said, okay, that's what it's going to be. But I would imagine that there is not a single legislator who could say offhand everything that's included in the revenue side and what things are excluded and why. So if it can't be understood in a useful way, it seems to me that the report itself, and as Senator Betzel said it, you can, if you want to use that formula, you can go ahead and do it and calculate it yourself, I guess. But I don't see that it's necessary for the report to be made at the time of the forecast, that's all. Okay. I just think it's outlived its usefulness, if it ever was useful, in the way it was intended, in the way in which Senator Merriam and I had intended it when we worked for a couple of years to get it passed.
Well, it sure seemed like a big deal at the time. Let's put it that way.
I know. I yeah. It kind of isn't a big deal anymore, and I would suggest that, without meaning to be insulting, that none of you know what it is for 2009.
16.25.
16.25.
Am I close?
Well, close is no cigar, Senator Robley. It's 15.
Like
it's 15.5.
Close.
Down from 16% last year.
Well, is there anybody else who's here who wants to be heard on Senate File 530? This is a policy bill that was sent to the Finance Committee because it was sent, but I don't know that it really affects the budget, so it doesn't necessarily need to be in the omnibus budget bill, so it probably could travel separately, I guess. So
that would be my motion. Okay. Senator Betzel and Senator Roebling, it's not the end of the world if it stays there, but I just think we need to be looking for places to clean up what otherwise I think are unnecessary mandates, even on the state, to make these reports. So, Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 530 be recommended to pass
to the Finance Committee. Senator Rust moves that Senate File 530 be recommended to pass to the Finance Committee. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The motion prevails.
1-1.
1-1. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Rust. Is there anybody who wants a division? Members, we almost finished the discussion of the governor's state government budget bill the other day. There's a few items we didn't actually get to. For instance, and if you've got the list here, for instance, in Article 2, the governor's proposing to eliminate the appropriation for the Target Center. That was in the contract for 15 years, and I think we already talked about that. So most of it's been done. But Article 3 was something we did not get to, and I did want to get at least a description to this budget division of what it was, and that is relating to the Environmental Quality Board. Again, that was something that was part of the governor's proposal. So we do have somebody, here who can describe just what the proposal was so we can have a better idea what's there. So welcome to the budget division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Angela Vogt. I'm an executive budget officer with the Department of Finance.
Okay.
Just to briefly go over that Article 3 section about the Environmental Quality Board, I'll probably skip over sections 1 through 19, if that's okay with you. That relates to the policy piece of it mostly. Section 20 has to do with the governor's recommendation on this bill. There's two pieces of what will happen to the total appropriation that was in the budget for the Department of Administration on this issue. The total budget in admin up to this point is $553,000 per year. In the governor's release budget bill, as a result of negotiations between the Department of Administration and the Pollution Control Agency, a reduction was taken at administration of $153,000 in order to recognize the efficiency of doing that transfer of the EQB to PCA. The remaining amount of that budget, $400,000, is reflected in the state government budget bill as it is, as a transfer from the Department of Administration, or out of the Department of Administration, excuse me. And that will be reflected in updated budget pages shortly here. Should be on our website in the next couple of days. The last piece of that of the bill, the subdivision 5, there's a small amount of money that's transferred every year to EQB from the DNR related to rulemaking. And all that does is that money will go with EQB to PCA. And so that's just subdivision 5 is just a recognition of that.
Okay, so the main reason why it was in this particular bill is because of the pass-through through the Department of Administration. It affects the administration's budget, but it's dealing with a different agency that's beyond our jurisdiction.
Okay. Mr. Chair, that's my understanding, yes.
Okay, and that's the reason why the budget bill was sent to the Environment and Natural Resources Committee, so to the extent
first.
That... Yeah, so if there's a desire for the administration to talk further about it, they'd have to do it in that committee because we don't have the jurisdiction over the EQB or the PCA. So.
And okay. Did that happen? That happened and then it got referred to us?
Well, the bill, because it had that provision in there, that's why the whole budget bill was sent to the Environment and Natural Resources Committee. I'm not planning on asking for a hearing. I mean, this is the administration's proposal. So to the extent the administration wants to, you know, discuss it further, I guess they have to make arrangements to go to that committee and discuss what they want. And, I mean, there's ways that it can be done, but, you know, that committee can fashion some remedy. But I don't know. They need this bill to do it. They've got their omnibus bill they're going to put together. But you know, it happened to affect the governor's proposals in the budget bill that comes to this budget division, although the bill is sitting over there, though. I don't need that particular bill to put together our budget bill. What we're going to do is just put together a budget bill and then send it off to the Finance Committee, and it'll be introduced as a separate bill. So mm-hmm. So I don't need the bill to move ahead. So So any questions about this provision, Article 3, on the EQB? Okay. Thank you, Ms. Voigt. We had hoped to finish it the other day, but we didn't get to it, so okay.
Thank you.
Okay, what do we have next week? What have we got? Okay. Just some bills next week. No, that's today's agenda, so.
Terry Bonoff.
Oh, okay, yeah. Monday, Senator Bonoff has the bill that was heard in GovOps on the Iran investments. We've got a couple of bills coming up on Monday. Wednesday, what was on the agenda?
Bills from other committees.
Oh, yeah. Okay. We've got bills from other committees that we're going to be processing next week. So we're going to be taking some more votes. So anything further? If not, the meeting's adjourned. Thank you.